of the second hour of We the People Radio. That was Bill in an unedited version of Blurting.
Blurting.
Nice blurting. Bill the Blurter. Oh, my God. Well, it takes a village, you know? So, welcome to our particular village. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, the Blurter.
You're fired.
Our sponsor...
what about my free commercial?
Oh, go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Free commercial first.
We'll put the free people before the paying people.
That's right. Because you know what? You should do it in order. Okay, free commercial this hour goes to Misty McEwen. She's a realtor at Coldwell Banker, and she is awesome. All the way from the start to the finish, I met with her like months before we were ever looking for a house, and I said, look, I don't want to get 10 million listings. I don't want to... you know, get dragged to a million places. I'm allergic to cats. I gave her the whole list. And then when I called her like 4 months later and said, all right, the time is now. She picked three houses. One of them was the perfect one. Bought it. Done. I mean, it doesn't get easier than that. Honestly, somebody who actually pays attention and gets the job done and didn't miss a beat, actually. She thought of a lot of things.
No, and she responded every time we had a call or an issue or whatever.
Well, I don't want to put too much pressure on her, but nights, weekends, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
Honestly. And she was really good on the text messaging, which was super helpful when I was at work. So you're looking for Misty McEwen. She's a realtor at Coldwell Banker. You can find her at MISTY, Misty, the number 4, realestate.com. Misty4realestate.com. Simple. And I will be happy to, I'll have the card on me. Actually, she's in my phone because she's a lovely person. So if you need to get a hold of us, you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Phone number, email's there for us, and I'd be happy to reiterate that. And now to the paying sponsor of this hour.
Our paying sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. And Pape will get it done. You need a tractor, you need implements, you need service parts. They do it all. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. So go up and see them. They do great work up there. And or you can give them a call, and their phone number is 226-9226. Or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com. And that's spelled P-A-P-E, machinery.com.
Deceptively simple, but often confused.
Yes.
And the phone's answered by a human, which anymore actually should be, we should really highlight that.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many places I call now, you get a stinking machine, and the machine wants you to tell it what you want, and it never, like.
I love the ones that give you,
it doesn't listen to what
press one for this, press two for that.
That's actually easier.
And yeah.
It's the one that wants you to.
Unless there's like 15 options, that gets a little
old. And it used to be you could just press zero and skip the whole thing, but now they're wise to us.
Yeah.
They're wise to us, press zero people. Oh, my goodness. Well, so first hour we talked about the internet and all the different problems there. This hour we're going to move on to underpopulation.
Yeah, this is...
Does the world face an underpopulation problem?
Yeah, that's kind of the other side of the coin here. Very interesting.
I know, kind of trippy. So Mr. Toopy is with us, and I neglected to request how I say the first name, so I'm going to hold on that. I'm going to tell you what he does, and then he's going to tell us who he is. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity, and the co-author of a new book called Superabundance, the story of population growth, innovation, and human flourishing on an indefinitely bountiful planet. Sorry, it should have rolled right off my tongue, but it didn't. That's put up by the Cato Institute here in 2022, so it's really current. You can learn more at superabundance.com. He's also the co-author of 10 Global Trends Every Smart Person Should Know, and many others you will find interesting. He's co-author of Simon Abundance Index, and the editor of the website humanprogress.org. So this is like a whole different zone for us. And please tell us how you say your name so I don't have to screw it up for you.
Hi, thanks for having me. My name is Marianne Toopy, and I'm with the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C.
Nice. I would have been close. That was my guess. Thank you so much for coming on. And so this hour, you kind of get to run it. We have a couple of breaks to take, and we'll ask you a couple of questions, but it's yours to...
Yeah, not too many people are
shine a light on.
We have an underpopulation problem. All you hear about is, oh, the planet is swarming with too many people, and that's why we're having all the problems we're having. But you have a totally different take on that, and I found it really interesting reading your article.
Well, thanks so much. Yes, right now in 60% countries in the world, something like 107 out of 190, people are having fewer children than is necessary for the replacement level. So replacement level is 2.1 children per woman per lifetime. In most countries in the world, as well as most regions in the world, which is to say Europe, North America, South America, Asia, we are well below the replacement level. In the United States, it's something like 1.7. You know, we are going to reach peak population in about 2060, and after that, population around the world is going to decrease dramatically. And that is going to have negative consequences in all sorts of areas. You know, we have a lot of unfunded liabilities, trillions of dollars, something like $100 trillion, that our government promised to future generations of retirees. You know, somebody's going to have to pay for it. We have a $31 trillion debt. Somebody has to pay for that. And, of course, economic growth itself may be slowed down if you don't have more people, because people are the only entity in the world capable of coming up with new ideas, new inventions and innovations. And if you have fewer people, you're going to have also fewer geniuses capable of discovering the new drug for cancer, or a new way of communicating, or a new way of transport. So basically, the world is not going to have a problem with overpopulation in the future, but underpopulation.
Well, that changes all the trajectory on the hysteria of limited resource, power, food. I mean, just all of it. All of it is predicated on, and there's a, I don't mind saying, we've done quite a few shows on people that are constantly talking about how we need to have fewer people on the planet.
Well, yeah.
And coming up with nefarious ways to get us to that point.
Yeah, we've always heard that you know, there's so many people, we're gobbling up all the resources, and we can't sustain it. And yet, some of these numbers that you were giving us show just the opposite, that the more people we've managed to put on the planet, resources, there's more resources, there's cheaper pricing, let's talk about that.
Well, right. So, you know, every new baby comes into the world with not just an empty stomach, but also a pair of hands, and most importantly, a mind that's capable of coming up with solutions to the problems that we have. And all you have to think about is, you know, compare the world in the last 200 years. 200 years ago, there was 1 billion people in the world. Today, there is 8 billion people in the world. And yet, the world is about 13 times richer per capita, adjusted for inflation. The United States is 24 times richer per capita, adjusted for inflation. So even though over the last 200 years, the world's population increased eightfold, our standards of living have skyrocketed. Now, this was not supposed to have happened. Most people think that when you have more people in the world, prices are going to go up, resources are going to go down, and, you know, life is just going to be much harder. But that's not what we found. We found that every 1% increase in population decreased the prices of commodities by about 1%. The key to understanding resources is to understand that the finite number of atoms in the world, finite quantity of zinc or copper or whatever, that's actually a largely irrelevant. What matters is the human ingenuity, is the new knowledge to be able to get out of those finite resources ever more value. A perfect example of that would be something like a grain of sand. Sand has been around for billions of years. And then some 4,000 years ago, we realized that by heating sand to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, we could turn it into glass jars and later into window panes. And now we are using glass in order to create fiber optic cables, which carry information at the close to the speed of sound around the world, you know, and impacting the global economy. So, you know, the amount of resources may be fixed, but the amount of value that we can get from them is increasing in line with human knowledge.
You also, between 1900 and 2018, you talked about the price of commodities going down with respect to the population. How did that work?
Well, basically what we did was to look at what we call time prices. Time prices is basically just whatever is the price in the shop divided by how much money you earn at the moment that you're buying the thing. And then you repeat the process 100 years or 50 years or 10 years later, and you see how long you have to work in order to afford something. So time price is basically just minutes and hours of work. How long would it take you to buy a pound of beef in 1900 versus now? And what we found was that for the same amount of time that it would take you to buy a pound of beef, let's say 1900, you could get 8 pounds of beef in 2018. So basically, your abundance of beef has increased by eightfold. We looked at hundreds of different commodities. We looked at food. We looked at fuel. We looked at minerals and metals. And every single time that we looked at things, it seems like Americans have to work less and less time in order to buy something because their wages are increasing, or at least they used to until the latest bout of inflation. But generally speaking, our wages are increasing at a faster rate than inflation, and also commodity prices are declining due to productivity gains. And once you put it all together, you realize that we really are extremely wealthy compared to our ancestors. Mm-hmm.
And with more people working, it creates more income, which creates more demand, which creates more goods, and that's really kind of the opposite of
That's right. But it's also the productivity gain. So obviously, if a worker is using a sickle in order to bring in the harvest of wheat, he's going to be much less productive than somebody who is driving a combine harvester. So you can see the productivity gains there. You basically can produce more and more wheat with better technology. We have GMO wheat, which can grow. Our yields are much higher per acre than they used to be, and also our technology is much better. So basically, this productivity of the capitalist system shows itself in both wages and also prices. So prices generally decline as you are able to produce more per acre of land. But also your wages are increasing because you are a much more productive worker. And once you put these together, you realize how much better off you are. And so in the book, if you are simply open-minded and you are willing to look at the data, you can see in our charts how we look at different food items and fuel and such, et cetera, and just see it just dropping. And I think that part of the reason why so many people are disenchanted is because they do not have the proper historical perspective. People generally don't study history, let alone economic history, and so very few people have a good idea about what life was like 100 years ago and how much poorer people were. Now, that doesn't mean that everything in America is working out. That doesn't mean that we cannot improve on things. Of course we can, and especially over the last 2 years, we have made a lot of mistakes. But the bottom line is, that the American economic system, provided that it is allowed to function properly, can actually produce higher standards of living, and we can show it with numbers.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're absolutely right. You look at 100 years ago and what it took to, produce goods then versus what it takes today, it's night and day. It's totally different.
Yeah, and it just doesn't, it's not just food, but also clothing, how much cheaper it is than what it used to be. I mean, in the old days, 100 years ago, let's say the end of the 19th century, you could really see a difference between a rich man and a poor man when you walked into a restaurant or walked down the street. People just dressed completely differently because the poor couldn't afford nice clothing. But clothing also gotten so much less expensive, and people can now afford nice clothing without having to be super rich. So it's a good country to live in, and I think that one of the problems is that right now politically we are so divided that there really isn't a constituency to emphasize the improvement in standards of living. You know, so when Republicans are in charge, Democrats are saying everything is going to hell. When Democrats are in charge, Republicans are saying everything is going to hell. And the reality is that we are living in pretty good time from a historical perspective.
Sure.
Yeah, and if you look back, even the I would imagine if you did the math, when you looked at your example, what the poor have now and what the poor had even 20 or 30 years ago, I mean, what qualified as being poor? I mean, imagine 20 years ago the poor all having cell phones. You know, when you like homeless people all having cell phones and things like that, that would just seem crazy. So
yeah,
we've elevated the standard of living for everybody at all levels in a lot of cases.
Absolutely. A colleague of mine that I co-wrote the book with, he's a teacher at BYU Hawaii, and he asks his students at the start of every semester, how much would it take for me to take away your cell phone that you can never use it again? And no student ever wanted to do it under $5 million. So basically you have in your pocket this $5 million machine that grants you access to the entirety of human knowledge and the entirety of human entertainment. That's just one way in which we are just so much much better off than our ancestors were. Your typical cell phone has much more computing power than the computer which powered the NASA missions to the moon. You have better technological capability, better communication skill capability than President of the United States just 20 years ago. And I think that we take all of these things for granted, and we shouldn't.
True. Yeah, mine fell at the gas station the other day and got run over by a car, so I had a self-imposed day of silence waiting for the new one to arrive. The phones are not rugged enough to be run over by cars, just in case anyone was going to go try that at home. Don't do it. It's a bad choice. We'll be right back. We have another 40 minutes to explore this topic, and you're listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Stop me now. I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball. Stop me now. If you want to have a good time, just give me a call. Stop me now.
I'm having a good time.
Stop me
yes,
now.
I'm having a good time. I don't want to stop at all.
Once I rose above the noise and confusion, just to get a glimpse beyond this illusion, I was soaring ever higher. But I flew too high. Though my eyes could see, I still was a blind man. Though my mind could think, I still was a madman. I hear the voices when I'm dreaming. I can hear them say,
carry on, our wayward son. There'll be peace when you are done. Lay your weary head to rest.
Hello?
Hello, we're back. We did the long version, sorry. Okay, so on the break, we were sort of discussing the idea that, okay, with more people, you have more brain power, which means you have more innovation, and you can advance your society.
If the society is allowed
to
innovate and free think, and that's isn't that the problem with a lot of these third world countries, is the populations aren't educated and allowed to innovate?
Well, that's right. Population itself cannot be the sole answer to prosperity. China has been the most populated country for 2,000 years.
Yeah, that's the one we were talking about.
Yeah, and same with India. And until recently, they were quite poor. So really, superabundance, which is what the title of the book is, can only be an outcome of population times freedom. It's only people who are capable of thinking freely, speaking freely, publishing freely, exchanging information, and then, of course, acting upon it, such as, for example, investing in the stock market, putting money behind their innovation, marketing it, then benefiting from it. That is the crucial component in superabundance. Now, the part of the problem with the world is that only a relatively small chunk of humanity is living in countries which are plugged into the global economy, people who are enjoying the fruits of the Enlightenment, so people who are enjoying the fruits of economic and political freedom. If we could bring Africa into the global economy and Latin America properly into the global economy and large chunks of Asia, then, of course, we could increase our economic growth, too. A perfect example of that would be somebody like Steve Jobs. You know, his father was born in Syria. And if Steve Jobs himself was born in Syria and spent his life there, he would never have access to the kind of knowledge, to the kind of funding that he was able to get access to in the Silicon Valley. He would just waste out his life in Syria. Part of the way in which you can increase productivity is by bringing smart people into places that are free, or alternatively, you can make the rest of the world free. But of course, we don't want to do that by force, so we just have to hope that economic and political freedom will spread in other places in the world so that those people can also have a crack at accomplishing something in the world. But yes, it is a problem. And of course, if democracies and capitalism decline around the world, then there will be an even smaller sliver of humanity that will be able to participate in this inventive process.
Yeah, because I would imagine there's a very small percentage of the population of the world that's providing for the rest of the population.
That's right. So we assume in our work, and there's some basis for it in evidence, that there is only a fraction of any population in any country which is actually inventors and innovators. We don't think that can be increased artificially. So let's assume that only 5% of people anywhere are innovators and inventors. Well, obviously, you're going to have many more inventors and innovators in a population of 8 billion than you would have 1 billion 200 years ago. But as I said, you know, there is 1.4 billion people in Africa. There are hundreds of millions of people in Latin America, billions of people in Asia. And many of them are not enjoying the kinds of freedoms that we have and cannot apply their minds. They cannot grow intellectually or have access to knowledge and capital that we have. And consequently, the world is probably underserved in terms of the number of innovators and inventors that we could have if the world was really fully free.
And why do you think China, having the largest population, hasn't been able to really crack the code? I mean, as far as providing and, you know, feeding their people, is it strictly political?
Primarily, it's political. Yes, China is basically an empire. It is a very, very large country with a lot of people, with the Han-dominated nation, and basically, Chinese have always had to make a choice whether to open up domestically and thereby becoming potentially less stable, or close up domestically and suppress any kind of innovative behavior, so as to maintain domestic political stability. And generally, during Chinese history, the regime in Peking, or Beijing as it is now known, decided that they would much rather have greater poverty and less innovation and less disruption to the system. Because, of course, innovation is very disruptive to the status quo. So when you allow people to think freely, that can be quite disruptive to the central government. And so the decision that the Chinese have historically made was to maintain this high degree of political stability at home by basically clamping down on any kind of disruption, independent thinking. And obviously, this this became most horrific in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. So during Mao's time, Mao killed about 45 million of Chinese people in order to maintain this political stability. And China was extremely poor. Then between 1978 and 2012, thereabouts, China has opened up. It became much more free. Of course, it wasn't as free as the United States, not by a long shot, but it was much freer than it was under Mao. And we saw this tremendous growth in the Chinese economy. And then with Xi coming in 2012, he decided to prioritize once again stability and Communist Party control rather than innovation and disruption. And as a result of that, Chinese economic growth has slowed down. And, you know, Chinese growth this year will be something like 2%, which by historical standards is very low. So my point is that, yes, as a general rule, it was the political system, the political regime in Beijing, which has been responsible for Chinese poverty, with a short exception between 1978 and 2012. But once again, China is retreating into its shell. And it looks like the Chinese economy is heading for very rocky waters. Indeed, they have a 20% unemployment. They have a very bad population pyramid because of the one-child policy. So, you know, that they are going to have a lot of very old people and very few young people. And so, you know, China, because of political decisions, has created lots of problems for itself.
Now, as far as the one child rule in China, when do you think that's really going to, have its peak effect? As far as
I haven't looked at those numbers. I mean, China has stopped the one child policy in 2015, and then allowed people to have two children. And as of a few months ago, Chinese people are allowed to have three children if they want to. But very few people have been doing it. You know, people have gotten used to smaller families, and they don't seem to be jumping at the opportunity of having many more babies. But you know, within the next 10 to 20 years, there is going to be a lot of Chinese who will go into retirement, and there are going to be fewer younger people willing to take those jobs. And it's not entirely clear how China is going to plug that particular hole.
Yeah, that when they started that policy, there was a lot of talk about how, you know, in 20 years when they need to replace a lot of workers, there's not going to be any younger people, and China was going to go into some real hardship.
But the control factor, I think, was too, you know, it was too intoxicating, you know, to control everyone's lives like that. They weren't willing to look to the future. It was working for them at the time. And I see that same political philosophy in our energy policy and in our environmentalism and all that stuff. It's all predicated on the politics of scarcity, getting rid of dams so we can get rid of hydropower, which is clean and green and inexpensive, making sure that everybody is stuck with these things that are limited and costly, is a great way to control your population. And for whatever reason, we don't seem to be learning from China.
Well, our problems are not connected in any way to the ability of the planet to support human beings.
Right.
The problems that we are facing in the West are due to very stupid decisions made by our politicians. So we are suffering from climate, but not climate change, but climate policies made by our leaders. That's a free choice that we can reverse by electing politicians who have a better understanding of what our economy needs. Now, like most people in California, I think, I'm pretty environmentally conscious. I think of myself as an environmentalist in a sense that I want to have a cleaner planet. But I also understand that that humans have to be taken care of. In other words, I think that there was a time when environmentalists understood that human flourishing came first, and if it could be combined with a cleaner planet, that was a good thing. But I think that in the last 20 years or so, maybe slightly longer, That sort of thing flipped, and now extreme environmentalists see human beings as a cancer on the planet.
Yep.
There are articles in newspapers frequently about how the world would be much better off without humans in it, how bringing a child into the world is an act of selfishness and things like that. I just completely reject that. If there are no humans in the world, then the world doesn't really matter, because the only reason why the world matters is that human beings are there to perceive it with our senses. Animals don't care about the planet. They care about eating, having sex, and not being eaten by other animals. To the extent that the world matters, it's because we are there to appreciate it. So humans matter, and I think that this extremist environmentalism has just gone too far, and we have lost the sight of the fact that human beings are central to this endeavor, human endeavor, and I think we just need to rebalance it a little bit
better. Yeah, and that they can be beneficial, that used like any tool, right? Like any tool, you can, hammers are a good example. We've been using a lot of hammers. We just moved, and so, you wind up fixing a lot of things. You can use it for bad things, or you can use it for good things, but a lot of their policy, when you really dig into it, it used to make you sound crazy, but anymore, you're kind of an idiot if you can't figure it out, that depopulation is the goal. And your article flies in the face of all of that, thank God.
There's no question that the richer the country, the better the environment. This is something that I wish more environmentalists understood. Poor people in poor countries generally don't care about their environment. They drop their trash, whatever they are. They will eat the wildlife if they are hungry. But it is people in rich countries who have the money and who have the focus and who have the determination to keep their environment clean. If you look at environmental rankings around the world, let's say the Yale University environmental ranking, which they publish every year, all the countries at the top of environmental protection and quality of the environment are rich countries. Our air, our factories, our electricity generation is just much cleaner than what it is in poor countries. So if you want to help the planet, the best way to do it is to turn as many countries as rich as possible.
Yeah, increase the standard of living and increase the ability for people. You know, when you're not starving to death and trying to survive, you can spend more time doing good things. But if you're just hanging on by a fingernail, that's all just a bunch of happy talk that nobody has time for. We need to take a really quick break, though. We're going to come right back. Hold that thought, because we'll forget it. So you're in charge of it. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. We're back. Our guest is Marion Tupi. He's a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the Cato Institute's Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity. I'm finding the fact that you've researched what many of us have just known and watched for such a long time. You've finally put the facts behind it, and that's just incredibly helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those kind words.
Yeah, it just, we have gotten ourselves, it's not everyone, it never is everyone, but the decision makers in our societies, especially in our bigger cities in the U.S., have gotten themselves into this mindset that we have to make everything scarce. And with more scarcity, we can control people better. We can convince people that they, shouldn't live in single family homes, shouldn't live in the country, shouldn't have more children, and basically shouldn't be happy. You should feel guilty. If you have time to go walk your dog and do pleasant things, that makes you a bad person. And it's like, when did that ever become popular? Ridiculous.
Well, it becomes popular when you can scare people into into believing in this apocalypse. I mean, we've been scaring each other for a very long time, and I think this environmental apocalypticism plays a very large role in it. I mean, after all, global warming may be a problem, but it's not an existential crisis. And this is not something that people are allowed to say. People want you to believe that it's an existential crisis, because, of course, if it's existential crisis, meaning if humanity is on the line, then they can force you into all sorts of behavior which would normally not be acceptable. And I do think that there are aspects of the extreme environmentalist movement which are set on control and degrowth. In fact, there is an academic discipline now emerging. It's called the degrowth discipline or degrowth theory. And basically, it's people in academia basically arguing that we should do with less, that we should stop producing as much as we are producing, that we should stop consuming as much we are consuming, that we should basically become poorer. And, this can only come out of academia, where tenured professors with $250,000 a year in salary are opining about what you and I should be able to consume. And I just completely reject that. I think that there are a lot of people in the United States who could easily imagine their standards of living being higher, not to mention people in the rest of the world who are not as lucky as Americans. And it is a fundamentally anti-American way of looking at things. Americans generally, historically speaking, they always wanted to have more things. They always wanted to be better off, more, better. They wanted the moon.
And it wasn't predicated on taking it away from somebody else. And that seems to be the prevailing narrative now, is if you have more, someone else has less. And that's why I like your superabundance concept, because that's not part of the picture. You didn't deprive somebody because you did well.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, I live in Washington, D.C.,
I'm sorry.
So I'm surrounded by people who don't produce anything and take away from others.
Bingo.
I live in a city where millions of people are basically parasites on the rest of America. You produce and we consume. So it's not like I'm completely alien or foreign to the notion of zero sum game and living at somebody else's expense. But as a general rule, people in America understand that they have to produce in order to consume. They have to drive a Lyft car or Uber. They have to go to work from 9 to 5 in order to earn their salary. They have to, man the shop floor or whatever in order to get the money. People generally understand that. Even the richest ones among us, like Jeff Bezos, they haven't stolen the money from anywhere. I get 20 packages from Amazon every week or every month because I am willing to part with some of my money willingly in order to get a superior service from Amazon.com or from Apple or from Tesla or whatever. These people have earned their money, and I don't begrudge it to them because again, as I said, they have created a service or a good that all of us in the United States want to use. So, yes, in any society you can have parasites, but by and large, capitalism rewards people who produce for their fellow human beings.
Yeah, as it should. I just can't stress enough how I think the people who listen, well, there are always people who listen to our show just so they can be mad. And, you know, we're happy to provide that benefit for you on Sunday afternoons. But there are a lot of people who listen because they want to find more proof of intelligent life out there. You know, the regular media just gives them the little one-minute thing, and everybody's saying the same 1 minute. We really, really enjoy bringing people like you onto the airwaves so you have time to explain. And honestly, your two websites, superabundance.com and humanprogress.org, I think both of those would be incredibly interesting. We do a lot of things on environmentalism and on the whole Agenda 21 thing, and have for many years, as we do a lot of different things, but that is one thing we've done. And you have a terrific video on there, Climate Alarmists Are Ignoring Science. That caught my eye. And then on humanprogress.org, I see you have Hannah Downey, who's a policy director, Property and Environmental Research Center. But she's got a thing on here, Free Market Conservation and Environmental Optimism. I'm thinking, well, that's sorely lacking. So if people want to read something and listen to things that are like kind of up their alley and maybe not just the same old junk recycled, I would point them to both of your sites. They're excellent.
Well, thank you very much. And I would simply add that, you know, I understand anger, and God knows there is plenty to be angry about
sure.
our political class and so forth. But I would just urge your listeners not to give up on the political and economic institutions which have made this country great. After all, you know, the United States used to be a poor and primitive country just like any other place in the world. And yet you have managed to build this extraordinary, rich and sophisticated civilization. I say it as a naturalized citizen. Obviously, I'm not from here. But you have managed to build this extraordinarily sophisticated and rich civilization because the Constitution and your institutions have provided for the creation of all this wealth. I would say that a return to the basic American values, such as hard work, long-term thinking, succeeding in the capitalist system by providing your fellow human beings with what they need. We can once again recapture that sense of optimism. So yes, anger is valid, but let's not burn down the institutions which made this country possible. Let's try to change those institutions. Let's try to fix them around the edges. But ultimately, I think that the quintessential American reliance on political and economic freedom is sound and produces results if it's allowed to function properly.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because I think a lot of people are at that point where they're angry at what's going on with the decisions that are being made, and so they're you either have burn it all down, or I'm not going to vote anymore. It doesn't matter. The elections are all rigged, blah, blah, blah. And I get it. And there's ample evidence of those things having problems. But to step away from the whole system and not try to recover it, I think would be the greatest mistake people who believe in the country and what it stands for could possibly do.
I also think that America has within it a perfect system for rebalancing things, and it's called federalism, something that the Founding Fathers were very keen on. The notion that if you're living in a state which is not functioning properly, you can always move to a place which is functioning better, which offers you the kinds of liberties and responsibilities that fit your personality. One thing that I'm seeing increasingly is that people are moving who are dissatisfied with the governance in their own states to other states which may have maybe lower taxes and better business environment and so forth. And that's also a valid response to political difficulties, I think. So returning back to federalism and decreasing the amount of intervention by the federal government, by Washington, is, I think, a very promising road back for the United States.
Yeah, and I think what you were talking about there, people moving from state to state, I think that sends a very loud message to those governing bodies that you're going to lose your population if you don't get things, you know, you don't get the ship righted, people leave and go to greener pastures. And I think we're seeing a lot of that now, but I kind of have hope that at some point it'll turn around and people will have a little more common sense and bring it back to more, you know, closer to center and not, you know, all the way to the right or all the way to the left. I think we definitely need that balance.
We are in agreement.
Yeah, it's interesting. How long, give us a little bit, we've got a couple of minutes here. I'm curious about your background. Like, how did you wind up working on this?
Well, I was born in Eastern Europe, in Czechoslovak Socialist Republic, so I was 13 years old when communism came crashing down.
Oh.
And then we left. I mean, we would have left before, but of course they wouldn't let us leave. Communism built a wall in order to keep people in, so that we wouldn't leave, otherwise everybody would have left. And then I was studying in Britain, and when I got my PhD, the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. hired me, and I've been working for them ever since. So I've been working on Human Progress for about 10 years. And again, it's been a great experience. When you look at the data, be it life expectancy or calorie consumption or child mortality, things are improving around the world as a general matter, and so there's a lot to be optimistic about if you just look at the data. And we include in our book Superabundance there are chapters which are devoted to human progress in general, showing you how in many ways the environment is improving, how life has improved over the last 200 years. So I hope that your listeners, at least some of them, are open to looking at the data and making up their own minds. I mean, we don't lie. We use the reputable data from around the world to show that the world is really improving as a general matter. Now, the last 2 years have been very difficult for everyone, and our governments have made a lot of mistakes, but over the last 200 years especially, the world has become a better place.
And that's funny, because if you listen to most of the prevailing talking heads out there, they'll all tell you that, you know, all the stories basically sound like life sucks and then you die. And you're busy writing a book called Superabundance. And I'm like, what a great world we live in.
Well, and yet,
God bless you.
People say that life sucks and then you die, and yet everybody wants to live as long as possible.
Isn't that
people
funny?
People go through extraordinary lengths to take vitamins.
Yeah, that's
and,
true.
Life-extending drugs, and when they're bedridden with some sort of a disease, they don't want their families to pull the plug on them. They want to carry on as long as possible, no matter how much the expense to the taxpayer. What does that tell you? It tells you that that many people just virtue signal by saying that the world is horrible. In reality, all of us want to live as long as possible on this earth, because on balance, we enjoy it much better than we resent it.
I think they need to all run out and buy Superabundance, and it should be a nighttime reading for every family. Everybody could go to bed happy for a change. Our guest has been Marion Tupi. You are wonderful. We would love to have you back any old time. You're always
anytime.
Welcome here at We the People.
Thank you very much.
You can find this this interview archived at wethepeopleradio.us later this afternoon.
We will rock you.